Hello, this is the first in a five-part interview series with Ilya Maslyansky on Russian internet manipulation. In this part, we will be talking about the pivotal 2011 Duma election that opened Putin's eyes to the internet's potential.
Hello, and welcome to the NATO Association podcast. I'm Benson Chung, your host for this episode, and today we'll have a guest talking about the history of Russian misinformation. In recent weeks, tampered elections have been a big topic in North American media. Various American intelligence agencies are accusing Russia of manipulating the results of the presidential election by spreading misinformation through WikiLeaks. Germany is worried that Russia would do the same with their federal general election next year. But how did Russian misinformation become such a serious phenomenon? And how is it that Russia is so proficient in waging an information war? Joining me today is my good friend and former classmate Ilya Maslyansky. He's here today to talk about his senior thesis research about digital manipulation of social media by the Russian government after the highly contested Russian parliamentary election of 2011. And boy, is his thesis timely or what? Hello, Ilya. Welcome to our podcast.
Hi, my name is Ilya. Just to tell you a bit about myself, I recently graduated from U of T, where I specialized in political science and minored in history. I was born and raised in Ukraine and came to Canada 5 years ago for my education. I plan on continuing on studying on the graduate level in political science. And yes, as Benson, as you said, today I'll be talking about sort of Russian tools of controlling the internet and misinformation and all the fun stuff that's been going on all the way overseas.
Right, fantastic. So why did you choose this topic for your paper?
To be honest with you, when I was thinking of what to write my senior thesis on, and the idea to write a senior thesis sort of came just because I wanted to, you know, write something big before I graduated, a lengthy project that I would, where I would have complete freedom to write on whatever I wanted and actually produce something original. So at first I thought of writing about traditional media in Russia, traditional media being TV and newspapers, radio, things of that sort. But then as I was doing some research on that, you know, sometimes in the footnotes, sometimes in related articles, I would find more and more stuff on the state of internet freedom in Russia, and that stuff was just so utterly fascinating and interested me so much that after speaking to my supervisor, I actually decided to completely change my topic, actually a couple weeks into doing research for my senior thesis, and decided to go ahead with the relationship between the state and the internet in Russia.
Okay, that's a really fascinating turn that you had. So in your thesis, the first major concept that you introduced was the concept of authoritarian learning. What is it, and how did you quantify this concept?
So I find it easier to think of authoritarian learning where, you know, just in general, when we talk about authoritarian regimes, mostly here in the West, people like to think of them for some reason as, you know, these rusty, almost dysfunctional mechanisms that fall apart and, you know, stop functioning and sort of give way to democratization as soon as they're encountered with some kind of external or internal pressure and just are unable to keep up with things like technology and the internet. And I'd like to think that my research and my work challenges this mainstream way of looking at authoritarian regimes. And what I mean by authoritarian learning in the case of Russia is the regime's capability to adapt and respond to the rising challenger in the face of social media, and sorry, in the form of social media and the internet that sought to challenge the regime's hold on power in 2011 and beyond. And one of the major conclusions that I draw is that Russia, and perhaps, you know, this could also apply to other undemocratic post-Soviet states, are not necessarily these rusty, you know, mechanisms that just break down whenever they are encountered with something external that they can't keep up with. And this technology that many would say, you know, can liberate and modernize society, social media and the internet, can actually be used to consolidate the regime's hold on power and could lead to very, very serious circumstances, you know, for the opposition and for things like freedom of speech in these societies when the government starts sort of tapping into the internet and the social media instead of resisting it and trying to outright block it. And I think when we talk about the Russian case in particular, I would like to introduce a concept, namely internet controls. There is this famous political scientist at the University of Toronto called Ronald Deibert, who specializes in cybersecurity, internet freedom, and things of that sort. And in his research, Ron Dieber talks about three generations of internet control that I think is very fitting to introduce now, because I'll be making reference to them every now and again during our time here at the podcast. So Ron Dieber talks about three generations of internet control. The first generation is, think about something like the Great Firewall of China. Outright access denial, you cannot access a certain website, dead end, that's it. That's the first generation internet control. A second generation internet control is something along the lines of the authorities of the government, or, I don't know, internal security agencies, restricting access to certain information, certain websites during key events that are happening in countries. So, for example, an election or a protest is happening outside of, I don't know, the parliament building, and, you know, all of a sudden, all independent media in the country becomes shut down for the time being. So this strategic denial of access during certain times when this information could, lead to huge developments in the country, that would be a second generation control. Most of the time the information is available. Whenever the regime feels threatened, it shuts down access to that. That's the second generation control. Mm-hmm. So very strategic sort of manipulation of when people can read what. And the third generation control is perhaps the most interesting and the most covert one. Because there, instead of restricting access outright or doing it strategically, as is done in first and second generation controls, here the authorities seek to tap into social media and the internet and actually openly contest and sort of compete with these adversaries in cyberspace. So I'll definitely touch on that later during my talk, but think of something like Twitter bots, internet trolls that cannot directly be traced back to the government, but that, you know, clearly serve the interests of the status quo in any given country. And, you know, the reason there being, you know, the status quo, you know, sort of seeks to undermine its adversaries in cyberspace by directly engaging them in cyberspace. So that would be a third generation control.
Okay, so I take it that the third generation cyberspace controls were a more recent development. So I'm wondering, what was the state of Russia's internet sphere like before 2011?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question, and as I'll explain later, 2011 was in many ways a turning point for the relationship between the government and the internet and social media in Russia. And the Russian internet, often called the RuNet, before 2011... was a space where people could more or less openly share any kind of content that they wanted. You know, internet and online piracy used to be extremely widespread in Russia, you know, just a decade or even 5 years ago. But not just that, you know, more relevant to what I studied, it was free from direct government surveillance and control, and, you know, things like blogs and live journals for opposition activists, they were open access, anybody could read them, people felt more or less comfortable, sharing their thoughts in various forums and things of that sort. Social media websites, including Russian ones like ВКонтакте and Одноклассники, were also sort of free from direct governmental control. So in general, I would say that the things have been pretty laissez-faire before 2011 with regards to this relationship between the status quo and the internet, which was definitely not the case for traditional media. Which was privatized, and then firstly during Yeltsin's time after the Soviet Union collapsed, and was subsequently nationalized with the help of Vladimir Putin's policies, you know, starting in 2000 when he was first elected president. So the traditional media stood in stark contrast to the internet and social media in 2011, because by then major TV channels, major newspapers were already directly or indirectly controlled by the Kremlin, the Russian establishment, whereas the internet wasn't.
So this is the state of affairs leading up to the 2011 Duma elections. So what exactly happened in 2011? How did the opposition organize to prevent the rather expected electoral fraud?
Okay, so in 2011, Russia was scheduled to have its parliamentary elections to the State Duma, and the State Duma is the lower house of Russia's legislature. So it took place in December of 2011, and, Russian voters were expecting a certain degree of electoral fraud. So there were many volunteers who decided they would volunteer, you know, to sort of monitor the electoral process. There is an independent elections watchdog organization in Russia called Golos, which literally means the voice, which partnered with a big newspaper and created an electoral map of violations that would be accessible to the public online, where people would be able to sort of log in and report electoral violation that they saw in their electoral districts and constituencies. Nevertheless, there were lots of instances of fraudulent voting, as people had feared at the time. There were instances of what is called carousel voting. And carousel voting is when a group of people votes multiple times on a different polling station. So imagine a carousel, you know, they sort of hop off, then they get back on the carousel, vote again, and do it again and again and again to essentially, you know, put more votes towards re-electing the United Russia Party, which is the governing party in Russia, was at the time in 2011, and is still the governing party to this day, often called, you know, Putin's party. So that was the state of affairs in 2011, and that's what the opposition was trying to do to prevent electoral fraud, which nevertheless occurred on a mass scale.
Given that the electoral fraud things did happen, how did the opposition respond to Putin?
What was new about this election is that there was a very, very strong online response. So in particular, Facebook and Twitter, Russia's domestic social media websites such as ВКонтакте and Одноклассники, were politicized to a lesser extent. It was mostly Facebook and Twitter that became really politicized and became, you know, the driving force and the organizing force behind these attempts to contest the elections. So the opposition tried to pressure the government for fair and transparent State Duma re-elections because they were dissatisfied with the fact that Putin's governing United Russia Party seized a majority of votes in the Duma. They organized various protest groups on Facebook and ВКонтакте too, but to a lesser extent, you know, where people would essentially responded that they would show up on a certain day to a certain location, you know, to peacefully protest against the fraudulent election. People also tweeted extensively about electoral violations that occurred at the time of the 2011 parliamentary election in Russia. And again, what was new about it is that the internet facilitated leaderless coordination. So these protest movements and these rallies were organized by horizontal means, which is very new for societies like Russia and Ukraine and other Eastern European countries, really, where, you know, in most cases, there is an established power, vertical power hierarchy, you know, where you know who is responsible for what, and it's essentially bureaucratized to, you know, all the way down the ladder. And, you know, here you have a completely horizontal, leaderless movement, you know, where you can't clearly identify who is responsible for it, and many people just showed up at the spur of the moment. It was a big crowd. So this was a very new development, and as I argue, the regime was simply not prepared for it.
So if this really was a new development in terms of protest movements, the Kremlin might not have been prepared for it, right? So how exactly did the Kremlin respond to these protests?
So there were several ways in which the Kremlin responded. You know, the Kremlin here obviously being the Russian political establishment or the status quo. So, and, you know, Ron Deibert's three internet control mechanisms that I mentioned at the beginning of my talk come in handy here because what they used were second-generation controls. And, you know, just to remind you, these are various methods that the regime or the status quo, you know, might use when access to information, you know, is really, really key during those moments. So on December 10th, 2011, that was, you know, already after the election results came in and, you know, exit poll data was at odds with official results from Moscow. So, you know, people clearly knew that the election had been fraudulent. There was pressure for fair re-elections. It didn't happen. So people organized themselves on Bolotnaya Square, which is very close to the Kremlin. It's basically at the Kremlin's doorstep. And on that day, 50,000 people showed up to demand fair re-elections. And this is when the Kremlin used its second-generation controls. So, for one, mobile internet was unavailable on Bolotnaya Square on December 10th. So it to make it more difficult for the opposition, you know, to coordinate and, I don't know, message maybe their local leaders, you know, who were sort of organizing blocks of this protest, or, you know, even access news websites to see what was going on and how the regime might respond. That is one thing. Another thing is that leading to these protests, and actually during the electoral process as well, there were distributed denial of service or DDoS attacks that were... These DDoS attacks targeted independent news websites that posted about the electoral fraud in Russia. And the map of electoral violations that I mentioned earlier came under fire as well. It was unavailable during key moments of Russian parliamentary State Duma election in 2011. So it's almost, I think it's helpful to think of it this way. So think about it. When was this information about electoral fraud and all these violations that occurred most important to the protesters? You know, obviously during the electoral process when it would be proper for them to go online and document it. Or, you know, they would need mobile internet to communicate with each other when they organize these protests. You know, the Kremlin obviously felt unsafe about these various developments, and this is why these distributed denial of service attacks happened when they happened, during these crucial moments. And, you know, there is no evidence that directly links the attacks back to the political establishment. But when you think of the timing, when you take into consideration all these things, it clearly served the interest of the regime at the time. So I think it's fair to say that the Kremlin stood behind the attacks, or groups associated with the Kremlin, which would likely be funded by the status quo as well.
Right. So why do you think that Putin or the Kremlin responded so harshly to these protests? What changed in recent years?
So my answer to this question will be twofold. So for once, you could think of, you know, more of a geopolitical context of, you know, 2011. You could think of things like the Arab Spring, you know, the color revolution that, you know, happened years prior to that, where the internet, you know, was a force as well, as it was during the Arab Spring. And actually after, just 3 months later, so it was of March of 2012, after the parliamentary election took place, I believe it was the principal chief of the FSB, and the FSB is Russia's internal security agency, the primary one, he said that the government in the years to come would seek to find ways how to combat what they called Western influences on the internet and, you know, the social media in Russia, because he stated Russia realized just how much potential this stuff had and how much mobilizing and how much potential to undermine the status quo this had, as had been, as had become evident during the color revolutions and the Arab Spring. And the second part to why the Kremlin responded so harshly has to do with the fact that, again, as I mentioned previously, this was a completely new development for a country like Russia, where you have a leaderless, anonymous, faceless force, you know, where 50,000 people are gathering at your doorstep, you know, want to throw the rascals out and, you know, demand fair re-elections. This was entirely new. It was completely unprecedented. You know, when there were protests, the dying days of the Soviet Union, clearly it was not organized with the help of the internet and social media. So Russia's, you know, the authoritarian regime in Russia was faced with these new online revolutionaries that found a way to organize themselves in ways that the regime was still not ready to combat in traditional ways, because, you know, it's if it had to deal with, you know, just you know, getting rid of or imprisoning one person, that would be another thing. But, you know, there were these 50,000 people that got there through online groups.
So the internet basically became a force multiplier for pre-existing trends and precedents in protests in the post-Soviet sphere.
In a way. Yeah. And, yeah. You know, I'd also like to add the fact that Pavel Durov, who is the founder and former boss or CEO of Kontakte, which is Russia's Facebook and the largest social network in Russia and essentially in all of the post-Soviet space, he was pressured by the FSB to shut down protest groups. Facebook, as I said, was a bit more prominent and important in organizing these people, but Durov was pressured by the FSB to completely shut down these groups to prevent people from organizing. So, you know, clearly the Kremlin sought to exert direct pressure on people like Durov because they feared just how much the internet and all these online groups could do to them and these events that people created and simply clicked that they would go to.
And so in the end, nothing really came of the 2011 protests against the elections because the media controls effectively stifled dissent. Am I correct?
Yes, that is essentially what happened. The re-election never happened. The United Russia Party retained the majority in the State Duma. And yeah, that's what happened. You're right.
This concludes the first part of the interview series. In the next segment, we will be discussing offline responses to internet media companies. Thank you for listening.